The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this Honorable Court.
Thank you. Please be seated. Court has one cause on its oral submission docket today, and that is N. Ray TXU Electric Company, a petition for writ of mandamus. Justices Hankinson and O'Neill are recused from this case, and at the court's request, the governor has made two appointments to the court in their place. We didn't request these individuals, but we requested that two appointments be made. And the governor, pursuant to statute, appointed Chief Justice Scott Brister of Houston and Judge David Godbee of Dallas. And so they have taken an oath as temporary justices of the Supreme Court of Texas and join us in the decision and deliberation of this matter. These arguments are being recorded by the clerk of our court, and you may purchase a tape of the argument for a nominal fee from the clerk. We are now ready to hear argument from relators in NRE TXU.
May it please the court, Mr. Duggins will present argument for the relator. The relator has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. Unless this court intervenes now, the one and only opportunity to make the transition to a competitive retail power market, as directed by the people of Texas through their legislature, will be irretrievably lost.
Mr. Duggins, can I ask you a couple of questions, please? On your brief on the merits, you have an issue. Did the Public Utility Commission of Texas abuse its discretion? And then in the suit that you filed in December in the District Court of Travis County, the PUC is the only defendant. And as I understand, the issues are the same in that appeal as they are here. Is that correct?
Similar issues were raised in that suit.
Why are the individual commissioners respondents in this mandamus?
Because they are state officers subject to this court.
I know, but your prayer for relief is only against the PUC of Texas, so what is the purpose of having them individually or as commissioners?
Because as those three state officials, they comprise the Public Utility Commission.
But isn't that a separate entity by a legislative statutory scheme? The PUC is an entity in and of itself.
The PUC is an agency of the state, Your Honor.
You've asked for no relief against those three parts of the have you?
We are requesting.
No, you haven't. Have you asked for individual relief of mandamus against each one of those persons?
I believe that we requested the respondents be subject to the mandamus, Your Honor.
Well, if I might read. We ask the petition for mandamus be granted and that the respondent PUC be ordered to. I don't see any prayer for relief against any individual.
I stand corrected.
What about Betts and those cases that hold that we can't mandamus boards and commissions?
Your Honor?
Particularly since you haven't asked for any relief against any individual in this case.
The court has held, I believe, that if each member of a board is subject to the court's mandamus jurisdiction, then the board itself is subject to that jurisdiction. There is a case that was cited in our reply brief to that effect.
And which one is that?
I don't remember the specific case, Your Honor, right off the top of my head.
You do seek relief against the members of the commission in their official capacities, at least?
I beg your pardon?
You do seek relief against the members of the commission in their official capacities, at least?
That is correct.
Can I get some clarification? When you originally filed, you were seeking relief from the order on certified issues and the interim order in phases 3 and 4. Are you now also challenging the final order?
Yes, and that was stated in our reply brief on the merits after that order was issued.
Has the PUC issued its ruling on the most free hearing?
It has.
Okay, and has it overruled that?
It has.
Okay. Now, but your complaint is the major part of your complaint is that they made a change based on natural gas prices that were high.
The basis of our complaint, Your Honor, is that they have directly contradicted several unambiguous affirmative statutes.
Which would not have occurred but for a fluctuation in natural gas prices.
Well, we believe that there were other errors that are not subject to this proceeding that understated stranded costs by billions of dollars.
But the argument you're making here is primarily as a result of the natural gas prices.
That is one of the reasons that the estimate that they have done on their computer model recently resulted in a negative number. It is not the only reason. Nor does that matter particularly, Your Honor, because the statutes command what they are to do regardless of whether that is a positive or negative number. The rerun of this computer model now was for the sole purpose of setting the competition transition charge. And if, in fact, the number was accurately done and came out negative or came out zero, then the only impact of that was that the competition transition charge should have been set at zero, not that several affirmative statutes should have been simply repealed by the Commission. What they have ordered is that all of our mitigation efforts cease immediately, directly contradicting the statute that requires those efforts to continue throughout this year. They have ordered that all of our redirected depreciation be reversed, directly contradicting the statute that says they shall accept that redirected depreciation for rate-making purposes. And they have ordered that all of the excess earnings be delivered to retail electric providers through an extra statutory excess mitigation credit, directly contradicting the statute that says those excess earnings are to be applied to write down the book value of generation assets.
Can the 2004 true-up correct any monetary loss? I know you have a competition argument. What's going to happen to the market in the meantime? But can the 2004 true-up correct any, for want of a better expression, monetary component of injury that you or the marketplace suffers here?
Yes, Your Honor. If in 2004 it turns out the legislature was right as opposed to PUC, and we do have stranded costs, at that time the Commission is given the authority to impose additional competition transition charges via what could turn out to be huge surcharges,
yes, but
which would further disrupt the market.
What if you don't? What if you don't have stranded costs in 2004?
Then at that time the Commission is given the authority to reconcile any over-recovery of stranded costs.
What's the mechanism? A negative CTC? Or?
No, they can reduce the CTC down to zero. Of course, we have no CTC, so that one doesn't apply. They can reverse at that time any redirected depreciation in whole or in part, and if that's not enough, they are given the express authority at that time to reduce the transmission and distribution utilities rates.
That's the same as a negative CTC charge.
In practice, I believe that it is, Your Honor. It's a semantic.
We get a little confused because it seems to be a big argument that you can't have a negative CTC, but if they can reduce the rates, then...
In the final analysis, a reduction in the rates is a reduction in the rates, regardless of what you call it. The point is that the legislature gave them the authority to do that only in the 2004 true-up, when estimates of stranded costs are discarded in favor of actual stranded costs determined by market valuations. It is only after that true-up with the market valuations that anybody knows whether stranded costs exist, and if so, their magnitude.
Would you help me understand? I'm not sure I can clearly understand. I've looked in the statute, and it's not apparent to me how this is all structured after January 1, 2002. The existing utility divides into three different entities, essentially.
Yes.
Where do these stranded assets, whose books are they on? Are they on the power generation utilities' books?
Yes.
So how does that work? The T&D utility is collecting, in a true-up.
They are collecting the money for those stranded costs,
and eventually
there is a book transfer that takes them to the generation assets.
And where in the statute is that provided?
I don't believe that it is specifically in the statute, Your Honor.
Okay, let's say this is a nuclear facility, and it's on the books, it's an asset that belongs to, is on the books of generation utility.
That is correct.
Let's say it continues to be in operation and it generates revenues. But those revenues go solely to
the generation company.
So how is the T&D utility made whole ultimately, since I assume they're the ones, does the debt go with the asset, or how does that work?
No, the T&D utility is essentially collecting the money for the generation company.
You said there's a transfer on the books, so that money is funneled somehow to the generation facility.
Yes.
Utility.
Yeah, that's correct.
I haven't seen a lot of discussion about this court's decision in Corpus Christi versus PUC. Some did not believe that the PUC had the authority to maneuver these numbers prior to the true-up in 2004. But the majority of the court said no, that there's a general provision requiring the PUC to tinker with these numbers. And even though there's a specific provision that looks like PUC shouldn't get involved until the standard true-up, there's a permitted area that they can operate in. It seems to me that analysis works against Texas Utilities here. You're arguing, well, there's a specific statute that requires us to do the following mitigation issues. But the state argues, but there's a general provision that says you can't collect these in a negative CETC, and so we are exercising our authority to work within the framework of trying to get this to as good a number as we can get, not knowing we're all estimating.
There are two distinctions here.
No effort to distinguish the rationale that the court was using in that case to say how come that rationale doesn't apply here.
There are two major distinctions, Your Honor. First, your Corpus Christi case dealt with regulatory assets, which were known book numbers that were established in prior rate cases. Whereas here we are dealing with estimates that everybody knows are wrong.
Well, I thought it was talking about trying to figure out what was stranded costs, and so I mean
the securitization case has dealt with the stranded costs, in specific being those regulatory assets, those book entries that the commission had created in prior rate cases. Whereas here we're dealing with bricks and mortar.
Well, estimated cost, the ECOM is supposed to be the model you're to use is a model that then is updated by your information. So accepting that it's estimates, it's supposed to be the best estimates based on updated information directly from you, and then the commission goes in and looks at it. How's that really different in the analysis of PUC trying to get to a right number at the end?
Because here the legislature told them precisely what to do and when to do it through the detailed true-up provisions of Section 262A and Section 201L. What conceivable reason could the legislature...
Is that the 150-day rule I'm trying to figure out what was the time that they were to do this.
In 2004, in the true-up proceeding, are discarded in favor of actual values.
Okay. Maybe I'm not clear. The statute says that before January 1 of 2002, the PUC is to do something.
It was to
using the
that
ECOM plus an update of the... Right. Now, when can the PUC do that?
They have done it. The sole and only purpose of that estimate was to set the competition transition charge, which they have set at zero. What conceivable reason, Your Honor, could the legislature have had in giving the commission the express power to do specified actions at a specified time after the true-up to reconcile either an under-recovery or an over-recovery?
Well, let me ask you a question.
The commission already had that authority.
2 years ago, the PUC says this will be the number that we'll use on January 1, 2002.
The legislature said this will be the number we would use. It incorporated that specific set of assumptions in the
ECOM is what you're talking about.
Yes.
From 98. And because the statute requires that to be updated with the... You're making a distinction between when the PUC rules with updated information and what they're requiring.
The legislature incorporated that 1998 estimate into the statute, and it required utilities that came within those parameters to mitigate their projected stranded costs. It did not give the commission the authority when it redid the estimate this year to revise, revisit, or reverse the policy decisions that it incorporated into the statute. The legislature is hedging its bets here. if we turn out to be right, if the legislature turns out to be right, and there are billions of dollars in stranded costs because natural gas prices go back down after the true-up in 2004, we will have mitigated not a dime of those stranded costs. Because
let me ask about that. Is it your understanding that the current order reverses the depreciation redirection immediately?
Yes.
And what about, but the excess earnings refund is spread over 7 years.
Correct.
So only 2 years of that will have occurred by 2004.
Well, the statute says they're supposed to start the true-up sometime after 2004. By the time that happens and there's appeals, it will be more, considerably more than 2 years.
But that, so the effect is to have an immediate effect of a reversal of something like $1 billion and then the rest of it over a period of time.
Yeah, it's about $260 million a year in revenues from the combination of those two things, Your Honor. What they are doing here is that they are drastically decreasing the rate base of the transmission and distribution utility by the amount of the redirected depreciation, which is about $800 million in this case. And then they are further reducing those rates by the amount of the excess mitigation credit, which is about $900 million in this case.
What does that do? What does that do?
That has the impact, Your Honor, of drastically increasing the spread, the headroom, between our affiliated retail electric providers' dictated price to be and the costs incurred by our competitors.
Put it aside. Let's assume in 2004, whenever the true-up occurs, that the commission's order stands, you paid back the excess earnings, you reverse the depreciation, it turns out you do have stranded costs, and you are permitted to recover those stranded costs through a non-bypassable delivery charge. What does that do? Have you quantified the impact that would have on competition at that point?
Well, of course, that depends on the amount of the stranded costs that are ultimately determined based on the market valuation. But what you will have is a artificial competition, a house of cards built that when it turns out we did have stranded costs, will collapse. If we have huge surcharges after 2 years of competition, those new competitors will have costs, non-bypassable costs, that are going to make their costs higher than the price to beat. And that whole house of cards will tumble.
The price to beat will be gone at that point.
No, the price to beat is there for 6 years, 5 years.
Well, assuming the true-up occurs, you say it might occur sometime after 2000.
It just depends on how the timing all works out. The point is that no court's judgment then can revise history and put the customers and the competitive participants back in the place they would have been had the statute been followed.
Why wouldn't you want to use the most current information? Why would the legislature have chosen we like 98 better than whatever we know by 2001?
Because the legislature was trying to avoid the scenario that I just described to Justice Owen. It was hedging its bets. It knew that numbers could be positive or negative depending upon the assumptions that were made.
So it wanted to err on the side of over-recovery of stranded costs.
That is correct.
That's just the opposite of what 262 says, right?
262 is for the true-up in 2004.
Is there anything I can see in the statute that says we want to err on the side of over-recovery?
You can see it through the express statutory definitions. Every time in Chapter 39, the legislature referred to those estimates from the computer model, they talked about estimated stranded costs or projected stranded costs. But in 262A, they said that a utility may not over-recover its stranded costs, not its estimated or projected stranded costs, but its stranded costs. That is a statutorily defined term.
Did all utilities have stranded costs in 98?
No, they did not.
So one that whose stranded costs hypothetically arose after 98 is just out of luck?
They were subjected to the same true-up provision in 2004.
So we care about over-recovery of stranded costs for people that had them in 98, but not people that developed them in 99. That would be an inconsistent policy, wouldn't it?
It's the policy that the legislature set forth. It dictated only that those utilities that had stranded costs in 98 mitigate them. And the definition of stranded costs depends upon, it's defined as the positive excess of the net book value of generation assets over their market value. Market value is also statutorily defined for this purpose. It means the results of the 2004 true-up under the statutory definition. It is impossible to determine stranded costs until you have that true-up.
Are the hospitals and colleges correct? It's impossible to determine that until you've sold the last kilowatt? I don't know much about this business, but I assume nuclear plants don't swap hands frequently.
They do not frequently.
So, really, we're not going to have a market for nuclear plants. We're going to still be doing in 2004 what we're doing now, which is projecting.
Maybe yes, maybe no.
So, why is 2004 are we going to be? Why, if we're smarter in 98 than we are in 2001, are we not going to be suddenly smarter again in 2004?
They are actual stranded costs in 2004 because that's what the legislature said. There are numerous market valuation methods set forth in the statute. Most of the assets will be valued by that. Nuclear assets may or may not be valued by that under the statute. If they don't change hands, if there's not an IPO on the nuclear plants, then the ECOM model is used for that specific purpose. But at that time, it is a final number. It is not an estimate anymore. And at that time is when the legislature said that the reconciliation, up or down, was to occur. We have a substantive right to have the restructuring of our industry done the way the legislature said.
Let's assume that the commission's order stays in place and that it turns out when we get to the true-up that you do, in fact, have over-mitigated, that you have negative stranded costs. The colleges, the hospitals, colleges, and utilities say in their brief on the merits that the refunds would go to primarily, assuming that there wasn't much competition in your service area, that the refunds would go primarily to your affiliated retail electric utility, and that there's no guarantee that those refunds would be passed along to the actual ratepayers. Can you address that?
It's exactly backwards, Your Honor. We're starting out next month with all the customers in our affiliated retail electric provider. If we do these refunds now, the vast majority is going to our affiliate. And our affiliate is prohibited from passing those through to ratepayers. They have to charge the price to beat, no more, no less. On the other hand, if we follow the statute and it turns out that the commission's right and we do have we have over-recovered our stranded costs in 2004, at that point, the refunds happen. At that point, the distribution and utility rates decrease drastically, and at that point, competitors come flocking in because of the decrease in the transmission and distribution rates. And at that point, the refunds will go to all of those reps.
Let me ask you a question.
Explain to me how they have to go to the ratepayers as opposed to the shareholders of the rep.
The affiliated rep or the competitive rep?
The affiliated rep.
They don't have to at that point, because at that point the affiliated rep may still be constrained by the price to beat.
Well, let's assume once the price to beat is gone and you are still refunding essentially excess mitigation costs and they go into your rep's pocket, how is there any guarantee that those refunds will be passed along to ratepayers?
The guarantee at that point is competition, because if the price to beat is gone, we will be competing with all of these other reps, and to meet their price, it is a statutory assumption that any savings are going to be passed along to ratepayers.
What if there is very little competition?
I don't think it can work that way, because if there are huge refunds in 2004, those refunds take the place are done by a decrease in the transmission and distribution rates, which greatly increases that spread and creates competition. This is what the legislature had in mind.
Can I ask you about your assertion your harm is irreparable? And could you articulate why and what substantial rights, particularly in view of what you just said, that the true-up in 2004 will take care of the competitive situation?
The difference, Your Honor, is that in the crucial early years, we will have done this under a plan set forth by the PUC instead of the plan set forth by the legislature.
Well, but
and a court's judgment.
My point. why is that irreparable harm when in 2004 the true-up will adjust all of this?
The true-up will change things. The true-up isn't going to take history back and make things the way they would have been had the legislature's plan been followed. It can't.
Well, doesn't the whole scheme by the legislature envision a loss of customers by existing utilities who formerly had a monopoly?
Sure it does, Your
Honor.
And
it says if the 40% is what that loss of customers is, then the price to be changes and the rates change, and everybody knows that's going to happen in 2004. Is that right?
Well, that doesn't happen necessarily in 2004.
Well, but that's at least the date that the statutory scheme says this true of, to get actual stranded costs determined, right, and so forth. What does that do to your argument that your loss of market share is your harm and that it's irreparable?
Your Honor, I don't know that we're going to lose market share. I don't know what's going to happen.
Well, then tell me what your irreparable loss is.
The irreparable loss is to our substantive right to have this industry restructuring done under the legislature's plan, Your Honor. And that can't be fixed after the fact. Once it has happened, it has happened. It may turn out that the PUC's plan is a better one. It may turn out that the legislature's plan is a better one. But we have a right, and the public has a right, to have it done under the legislature's plan.
But the legislature did not plan for a non-standard true-up. It only planned for a standard true-up, and the court has said we've got to give the PUC some flexibility because nobody knows what's going to happen. So,
but in this case, Your Honor, the legislature has specified when the true-up is to occur and what the permissible actions that the commission can take as a result of that true-up are. How can it be said? What reason could the legislature have had to give the commission specific powers to be exercised at a specific time to reconcile mitigation up or down if the commission already had those powers and any others it could dream up that it could exercise at that time or any other time it pleased?
Why isn't the commission's reading of 262A at least a plausible one in which the court should defer regulatory expertise?
It is not plausible for at least three reasons, Your Honor. First, all of 262, as it states on its face, deals with the 2004 true-up. That's the only time we know if there are stranded costs that have been over.
It talks about other sections in the chapter.
That's right. And those other sections are to be considered during the course of that true-up in 2004. Under those statutory definitions, you can't know whether there are stranded costs until you have a market valuation, because that is the definition of market valuation, which is incorporated into the definition of stranded costs. That interpretation also runs afoul of the very basic principles of statutory construction. Because if that one sentence of 262A means what they say it means, then the remaining sections of 262 and the provisions of 201L that detail when and how that true-up is to occur and what the commission can do as a result of that true-up are completely superfluous. They haven't been able to give you any reason, any meaning to those statutes, those specific true-up statutes, if they already have the authority to do whatever they want, whenever they want, to avoid an over-recovery of a stranded cost estimate.
Let me add an estimate we know is wrong.
He has one more.
I'm sorry.
Do you have one more? You said three reasons.
The 262 deals with stranded, with the 2004 true-up. The definitions of the statute mean that you can't know if stranded costs have been over-recovered until you have that true-up. And the basic principles of statutory construction do not let you have that general provision completely override the detailed, specific grant of power to the commission for a specific purpose at a specific time.
Okay. Just so I'm clear on your position, one of the things that's at issue is the PUC's reliance on this ECOM in determining this estimate issue for the period of 2002 through 2004.
Yes.
What they are to consider, that ECOM is a model. What they are considered is that model updated with information from your company. If the, and let me understand, your position is that if the PUC is making this decision in 2001, by statute, the company is only updating the ECOM based on the company's records from 3 years previously, from 1998. The statute talks about the ECOM to be updated with the company's information for the PUC's consideration, has to be information from 1998 updated, not the information at the time the PUC is holding the hearing.
No. No, the update was to use current information with certain exceptions. But the update was for a specific purpose, to set the competition transition charge, and no other purpose. The legislature did not give the commission the authority to use that update to stop the mandatory mitigation of projected stranded costs, or to reverse the redirection of depreciation they were commanded by the statute to accept, or to take the excess earnings that the statute commands be applied to generation.
So the two are unrelated.
That's right. They have different purposes. The 1998 estimate was the one incorporated into the statute and used to decide.
And that had nothing to do with the rates or anything else being set.
Its purpose was to decide which utilities would be subject to these mandatory mitigation measures.
That has nothing to do with rates.
Right.
Okay, so this is just something out here for accounting purposes and has nothing to do with what the PUC will set for the rates that can be charged after January 1, 2000.
The first one, the one that was incorporated in statute, I agree with that. The second one did have an impact on rates. The second one was part of this rate case, and its purpose was to determine if there would be a competition transition charge, and if so, how much.
Okay. Your position is those are unrelated.
They have entirely different purposes, and only one of them was incorporated into the statute.
One does not affect the rates.
Right.
Okay.
Mr. Duggins, I've got a little lost in this statute here. For 2002, the commission can eliminate, can decide a zero CTC, right?
Yes.
And if the PUC is in fact right that there's over recovery of costs, where is it in the true up that they can undo that?
That is in section
201L. See, I look at 201L, and it says if it's found in the true up, the competition charge is larger than is needed, they can do these things. I see in 201L how at the true up they can undo what they've done with the CTC charge, but I'm not. Where do they undo what's been done under 254 with the transfer depreciation, et cetera?
It says if it is found in the true up proceeding that the CTC is larger than needed to
right.
recover
so,
remaining
so in effect, in effect, they can retroactively take the CTC back down to zero again. But where
well,
do they
if
do?
If the zero is too large, if you have in fact over recovered your stranded costs, your actual stranded costs as determined in the true up, then a zero CTC was too large. And the commission is then authorized to reverse in whole and in part the depreciation redirection, or to reduce the transmission and distribution rates, or both.
I thought you rely on 39.262, the true up, not the interrelated.
They are interrelated. 262 it has a number of true up provisions in it. The specific true up of stranded costs occurs under the procedure of 262, but 201L tells the Commission what it is supposed to do as a result of that true up of stranded costs.
Well, let me ask you about 262 then. I thought 262G says alternatively, if the Commission determines that the non-passable delivery rates are larger than needed to recover transmission and distribution costs, you can reduce, and it's got four options. I thought that would be the statutory authority where the Commission could rectify over-collection or over-mitigation. Assuming you have zero CTC, but you've over-mitigated, and you have negative stranded costs, I thought G would be the statutory authority in 262.
They are complementary, but I believe that G is talking about the T&D utilities costs.
Right.
not stranded costs.
The DEF costs of 262, not stranded costs.
Right.
That's what G is.
Right.
Well, that's
they say the same thing. They give them the same authority.
What is the non-bypassable delivery rate in 39.262? That's the only place I found it in the statute. Is that different from non-bypassable delivery charges under 201?
It cannot be. It depends. There are several non-bypassable charges. There is a system benefit fee, for instance, that is a non-bypassable charge. There's the transition charge, which is a non-bypassable charge related to the securitization that the Corpus Christi case was about. And there is the competition transition charge, which is the one we are talking about, which is expressly for recovering the stranded costs of brick-and-mortar generation
but
assets.
Would you agree that if you had over-mitigated and there were negative stranded costs after the true-up or at the true-up, that under G, the Commission could order you, could decrease your T&D rates to make up for that?
I can't agree with the terminology of negative stranded costs because I don't think that that's a possibility under the statutory definition.
Well, you've over-mitigated.
If we have over-mitigated, yes, at that time the Commission is given the authority to either or reverse all of that redirected depreciation, and if that's not enough for the reconciliation, then to decrease the transmission and distribution utilities rates, all of which is helpful to the emerging competitive market. All of which was the legislature's plan.
Technical question. Does the $2.745 billion estimate include the mitigation efforts that TXU's already done?
Yes.
Anything further?
In section 39.256, it deals with the option to redirect appreciation. There's a section D that says, notwithstanding subsection C, you shall not. Can you help me in layman's terms understand what you shall not do under D?
In essence, that is to restrict this redirected depreciation to retail rates for residential and small commercial customers. Most of what we have been discussing does not apply to commercial, large commercial, or contract customers. And the purpose of that statute is to make sure that the redirected depreciation does not impact the rates charged to those commercial and large industrial customers.
What were the prevailing natural gas prices when the bids were taken by the Commission were in July or August of 2000, and that's where they got the 3.2 something number. What was the prevailing natural gas price at that time? Do you know?
I don't know.
Is it lower today?
It is considerably lower today.
If we were to rerun the Econ model today, would you still have negative stranded costs or would you have positive stranded costs?
Just from the impact of natural gas rates, I don't know. If we did it and updated the price of power, including the capacity cost, the cost to build and operate a natural gas plant, as well as updating the natural gas prices, which the Commission did not do, then I believe that even today we would have stranded costs. But in 2004, anybody's guess is as good as anybody else's. We won't know until we have the market valuations. And the whole idea was to mitigate them now so that if it turns out they exist in 2004, we don't have to have huge surcharges then and destroy whatever competition has then begun. That is what the Commission has altered in the statute, and that is what cannot be changed by an appeal. And that is why mandamus should issue here.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
Yes, this is the court. Mr. Barron and Mr. Mendiola will present argument for the real parties in interest. Mr. Barron will open the first 15 minutes.
May it please the court. Before discussing the Commission's statutory authority to address excess mitigation in various provisions of the statute, I'd like to talk about what it is that's going to happen on January 1st, because that goes directly to the adequacy of TXU's remedy by appeal, its irreparable harm claim, and it also underpins two important points that I want to make about the jurisdictional issue. What happens January 1st, the date that retail customer choice begins? We know a number of things. We know that TXU, as the retailer, starts out as the monopolist with essentially 100% of the customers in its area. We know that that is the date on which new competitors may begin to try to get a foothold in the market. We also know that the legislature expressly envisioned, as Justice Baker observed, that TXU, the incumbent monopolist, should lose something on the order of 40% of the retail market within a three-year period. We also know from Exhibit 17 in the record that of all the states that have transitioned to competition, the most customers lost as of September 17th is in Pennsylvania, 12.5%. We know a good number of things about this excess mitigation credit that TXU claims, at least until oral argument, claimed was the basis for its concern about irreparable harm. We know that it is but one of many, many components that will make up the rates that are to be charged for transmission distribution charges on January 1st. The court need only look at Exhibit 9, the final order of the commission, and its first opening, 7 pages of table of contents, to see many of the other important issues that will affect the rates. And those transmission and distribution rates themselves are simply one of a set of other costs that the retailer must incur, the cost of power and retailing costs. We know the amount of that credit on this record. We know that the PUC consciously decided to spread out recovery of that credit over a 7-year period. So
why?
In effect, because the commission recognized in its order on certified issues that there is an uncertain period, and we don't want to...
If they don't have the authority to do it, why not just make them give it back?
Because the commission recognized that things change, that there is a true-up coming, that there will be new information, new opportunity to do things. So,
well, if things are changing, then why not keep a rolling proceeding going on to look at the estimates as they've been affected by natural gas prices, which everybody says you claim and you say
right.
You don't.
I don't know whether that would be authorized by statute, but what the commission did keyed off specifically on what it was statutorily mandated to do, the 2001 update.
But I don't understand why it wouldn't be. I don't understand why your argument isn't truly that the PUC can come in at any time and try to ameliorate this, as they see it.
Whether the commission could do that in another case, it seems to me, is an unanswered question. What the commission said it was doing here is looking at 262 and taking it in conjunction with the fact that it had to do this 2001 update.
But if the only way they can say that credibly under 262 is to claim a power that makes the rest of 262 superfluous, then that is material to our decision.
It doesn't make it at all superfluous, Your Honor. The final stranded cost true-up valuation that must be made under 2001L, all of those provisions will need to apply, because that process requires a comparison of the 2001 update with the 2004 calculation, which can be another ECOM calculation for nuclear plants.
But if at the end of 2002, it looks like it is going to be the case that there has been under-mitigation and the effect of a CTC charge in 2004 in the true-up is really going to impair competition, wouldn't the PUC feel some duty to come in and say, no, we changed our minds, now you need to start mitigating?
Well, not mitigating, but then they could make adjustments if they find that there are indeed stranded costs that need to be recovered in 2004?
No, in 2002, the end of 2002. If it looks like this was wrong, TXU was right all along.
All I can say is it is an unanswered question whether the commission would have the statutory authority to do that. What it did here was key off expressly what the legislature said should do by doing this 2001 update.
Well, I'm troubled by that, and help me here, because there are some very specific statutory directives that it looks like the commission has really flown in the face of. The first being that the statute specifically divides utilities into two groups,
yes,
by definition, those,
yes,
who have stranded costs and those who do not. And that's based on the 1998 ECOM, and the commission concedes that in its order. But what the commission has effectively done is to now take TXU and other utilities out of the category that is statutorily described, those who have stranded costs, and move them into the category of those who don't have stranded costs. Now, how can you square that with the statute?
This way, Your Honor. through 39.262A. That language in that statute operates, we submit, as an express qualifier or asterisk on expressly does on every stranded cost recovery provision.
So he gives you carte blanche to move anybody in and out of the category of stranded costs. So the 1998 ECOM has no further viability under 262.
The Commission's reasoning is that the legislature has told it to do a 2001 stranded cost update.
For the CTC?
262A, yes, to expressly. Yes. The Commission is not claiming that the statute says in express terms specifically, once we do the 2001 stranded cost update, thou shalt instruct.
But that, my problem is there are other directives that you're bumping clearly up against because you've got the statute divides, put TXU in the category of a utility with stranded costs. And that meant that Section 39.254 applied to it and 39.255 did not.
With the asterisk of 262A, which says expressly that a utility may not be permitted to overcover stranded costs through the application of the measures provided by the other sections of this chapter.
But that appears in 262, which is the true up, right?
Your Honor, it's placed...
Is that right? All right. Is that right?
It is, Your Honor. So is subsection
now, what
B.
Is it? Why can't you give full relief? Full relief and get the TRUF under 262. Why can't that be totally fixed in the TRUF if there's any over recovery?
Because the Commission believes that what happens in 2000, it has an obligation in the 2002-2004 period as well. Certainly things can be made, can be done in 2004.
I mean, I want to be very clear about this. Is there anything that can't be done in 2004 in the TRUF to fix this?
Yes. Yes.
What is it?
What cannot be done is in the interim period, utilities that are shown truly not to have stranded costs, estimated stranded costs based on the 2001 update, will be allowed to have the benefit of, in TXU's case, $1.6 billion in over mitigation, which would be discriminatory treatment during this interim period.
Is that right? All right. Is that right?
It is, Your Honor. So is subsection
B. Now, what
B.
is it? Why can't you give full relief in at the TRUF under 262? Why can't that be totally fixed in the TRUF if there's any over recovery?
Because the Commission believes that what happens in 2000, it has an obligation in the 2002-2004 period as well. Certainly, things can be made, can be done in 2004.
I mean,
but in the meantime,
I want to be very clear about this. Is there anything that can't be done in 2004 in TRUF to fix this?
Yes. Yes.
What is it?
What cannot be done is in the interim period, utilities that are shown truly not to have stranded costs, estimated stranded costs based on the 2001 update, will be allowed to have the benefit of, in TXU's case, $1.6 billion in over-mitigation, which would be discriminatory treatment during this interim period as against utilities that were put in the box of shall not over-recover stranded, don't have stranded
that's
costs.
That's my problem. Didn't the legislature put them in that box? I mean, did the Commission's now saying, well, we'd rather use an estimate in 2001. And when the legislature said, no, we're going with the 98 estimate, knowing that it could result in negative stranded costs.
Legislature, we submit, did not say we're going with those boxes permanently, inflexibly, forever in stone. It's similar to the non-standard true-up for which there was no express statutory authority.
But again, based on the 98 ECOM, you're either in 254 or you're in 255.
With the qualifier that says that those two specific statutory provisions may not be permitted to be, the measures in them may not be permitted to be applied in a manner that results in over-recovery.
Which you can fix, which is in the true-up provision, which can be remedied in the true-up.
But there's nothing in the statute that says the 262A is confined to 2004.
Well, what about the statutory provision that says under 256, that if the utility elects to redirect depreciation, that the Commission shall, and it sounds mandatory to me, shall
yes.
take that and put it and use it in the rates
in
all future rates.
They
have,
yes.
Again, you're not doing that. Are
you can't read that literally. If you did, it would flatly nullify 39.262G, which does expressly authorize the Commission in a future proceeding
to do that at the true-up.
But more importantly than that, the predicate for that provision in in 256, Your Honor, is that you have a utility that properly is eligible to mitigate stranded costs.
Basically, 262 gives you the commission the authority at any point in time to move utilities in and out of 254 or 255, depending on whether at a moment in time they are projected to have stranded costs or negative stranded costs.
That's not what the commission has claimed or done. What it has done is said, when this legislature has directed us to conduct a 2001 stranded cost update based on forward-looking natural gas prices.
We all agree
yes.
for the
and
CTC.
When the legislature says that no stranded cost, including the mitigation provisions, shall permit over-recovery through 262A, that latches on to those provisions. The commission believes that it has the flexibility within the statute to do what it is obvious the legislature intended.
262A and your argument there with 201L, that clearly starts 2 years after customer choice is introduced.
Yes.
How do you reconcile the two?
Well, the L provisions address what the commission can do after 2004. They don't say anything. They don't address the time period 2002 to 2004.
Didn't they address it by its omission?
We submit not because of 39.262A.
So let's go back to 262A. We don't know at this moment in time that there will be either over or under recovery of stranded costs, do we?
Well, the only thing we know, we do not know what the final valuation will be.
It's possible that TXU, you're wrong, the commission's wrong, based on current estimates, and there will be stranded costs. So we don't know that there's been over recovery under the statute. Isn't that the predicate to 262?
No, Your Honor. That's half of the predicate. The other half of the credit, because the statute talks about over-recovery of stranded costs, TXU asks you erroneously, we believe, to limit that to the final true-up provisions. The 254 and 256 mitigation provisions also talk about mitigating stranded costs, which is a concept that necessarily includes estimated stranded costs. Plus, if you look at underneath A, 262A to B, that's a provision that's in there that addresses the 2004 period. So the mere fact that 262A is placed under as part of the other provisions with final true-up does not mean, and there's certainly nothing expressed in the statute to say that the plain language.
I'll go back to the basic fundamental premise. He says what gives this commission the authority to override other specific provisions in the statute, including the division of whether you're the utility with stranded costs and you go under 254, or you're not and you go under 255. You say that it's because it's triggered when there has been over-recovery of stranded costs. And we don't know, sitting here today, whether there has actually been over-recovery of stranded costs.
Our interpretation, Your Honor, is that when the legislature used stranded costs in 262, as it used it in 254 and 256, that encompasses also estimated stranded costs.
So at any point in time...
That's not true. In the order on certified issues, the commission drew a distinction. It said that EMC is not a negative CTC in that it will address excess mitigation, not excess market value over cost.
That's correct. There will be a different valuation there.
Well, but if it's different, then what's the authority? The 262A only gives you authority over excess stranded costs, not excess mitigation. That's what the commission seems to be saying. The commission seems to be saying you don't have to worry about whether this is a negative CTC because we're only dealing with mitigation.
That's right.
But then the other side of the argument is 262 only says excess stranded costs. It doesn't say excess mitigation.
Well, the excess stranded costs kicks in, because 254 and 256, which talk about mitigation, talk about mitigating stranded costs. Let me explain the difference between a negative CTC concept and what the commission did with the excess mitigation charge. If that will help. A negative CTC is not what the commission did. It would be premised on the idea that there were indeed negative stranded costs. In this case, the estimate showed negative 2.7, this being the zero mark. And that the ratepayer, a negative CTC would say, ratepayers, you need to pay back in a negative CTC that negative stranded costs up to zero. The commission didn't do that. The commission, instead of starting with the premise saying you have negative stranded costs, the commission said, our legislative mandated updated estimate shows you don't have stranded costs to be mitigated. You're at zero. So you shouldn't be using the tools that are expressly designed only to reduce stranded costs. So that's the important distinction here.
But there's no difference, practically.
The money is the money. There's a $1.1 billion difference, Your Honor. In fact, it's less than that because we're only talking about two years out of seven until the final true-up. The Commission's order addresses $1.6 billion in excess mitigation out of a negative $2.7 billion in stranded costs. So this wasn't an attempt to put in a negative CTC and true things up in blanket fashion. This was keyed specifically to the fact that utilities, based on the legislatively mandated updated estimate, should not be using tools to mitigate down non-existent estimated stranded costs, which is what 254 is about.
And I understand that's your position. But if the PUC's power is as broad as it claims under 262A, it could have done that. It could have taken care of the other 1.1.
I think that's an unanswered question. The Commission did not purport to do it, and I think there might be different statutory arguments that doing it all the way like that might indeed run afoul of what the legislature contemplated there. Let me
respond to Mr. Duggan's argument that the policy behind this legislation and this scheme is to err in favor of overestimation of stranded costs so that you won't snuff out fledgling competition after the true-up in 2004 by having a surcharge.
Their argument would actually, if the CTC is eliminated, it would actually tend to hurt competition by eliminating the competitive margin. But to address the...
But I mean, it would be better to have competition start more slowly and then flourish later rather than have it start at first and then all these...
Certainly the legislature didn't say that. The legislature said two things. It said in 252A, 39.252A, utility shall be permitted to recover its net verifiable stranded costs. But in 262A, it said utilities may not be permitted to over-recover their stranded costs through the application of any of the measures in this section. So there's no bias.
You're saying basically the over-recovery doesn't mean what happens eventually, 7 years after the end of the final appeal. The over-recovery is month by month.
Well, not necessarily month by month, but within the statutory framework that was provided to the Commission. I don't think the Commission, as a practical matter, could begin to do month by month, but that would be pure speculation. But there's certainly no bias in the statute in favor of over-recovery or in favor of going slow in the interim. Let me get back, if I may.
Let me ask you what happens. Let's say that your estimates are wrong, gas prices stay low or even go lower, and other variables converge so that when we get to the true-up in 2004, there is, in fact, $1 billion of stranded costs. And now, you've got this charge that's in effect for 7 years. What does the Commission do at that point, and what does it take away that charge?
It factors that into deciding under an appropriate... The Commission has expertise in allowing recovery of large amounts over...
But you agree that under the statute, TXU is statutorily... It has to be able to cover its stranded cost.
Yeah, that's what the statute
And the Commission
provides.
Would have to put in a charge on the T&D rates to recover those stranded costs. What would that do to the competition at that point?
We don't know. And in fact, that's one of the reasons. What we do know on this limited record is that we have a excess mitigation charge that begins to go into effect on January 1st in the amount of approximately, for residential customers, $2 as compared to an average customer's bill of almost $100. So we're talking about, because the Commission spread out the recovery period, a reasonably constrained or limited period of time. Now, your question about what would happen, what the consequences are, I think illustrate, in our view, not only the TXU cannot show on this record that it will be irreparably harmed.
I'm not talking about TXU, I'm just talking about the scheme. What does that do to competition if you're wrong in 2004 and there are $1 billion of stranded costs that TXU is statutorily entitled to recover? What does that do to competition?
The Commission assesses at that time what the appropriate schedule should be for taking that into account and imposing an appropriate CTC or adjusting the level of T&D rates.
But you're saying $2 is material to competition there?
I'd say, Your Honor, we submit that the record just doesn't show that at all. And
so it's not going to hurt. It doesn't hurt independent REPs. If it's not material, it's not a competitive.
We don't know. And appellate courts do not have the authority to resolve factual disputes like that in mandamus proceedings, which is why we think that the better factual record, the place to make a factual record on questions like that, would be in a temporary injunction hearing ancillary to a regular administrative hearing.
So, the bottom line is you don't know, the commission doesn't know what altering the statutory scheme, we don't know what impact it's going to have on competition now or in the future.
The commission has made no findings on that. It couldn't make any findings on that. We've got this $2 amount for residential customers. TXU doesn't know. It may lose no customers to this $2 charge out of all the other cost variables. It may lose 500 customers. It may lose 1% of the market. But the big picture item, I think, Your Honor, is that the legislature said in this period, a three-year period anyway, we think it's appropriate, within the entirely reasonable, for the incumbent to lose 40% of the market within a three-year time.
Going back to your statutory, the statutory pinnings for all this, in the order, the commission says that one of the tools it's going to use is to first transfer TXU out of 254 as a stranded cost utility into a non-stranded cost utility, move it into 255, and that one of the tools, you said, available under 255 is to put into some sort of effect of the refund of excess earnings, essentially. But under 255, that stops December 31 of 2001. There's no statutory authority, even under 255, for refunding excess earnings past 12/31/2001. But now you're saying, well, close enough, we're going to call it that, and we're going to extend it beyond the deadline in Section 255.
There are two different ways, lenses through which the statute can be viewed. This, Your Honor, is a transition to competition that the legislature understood carried with it the inevitability of unforeseen consequences. And that's why 39.262A is in there to give the commission the necessary flexibility.
So the commission was wrong when it said it can allow 255 because that doesn't really give it the tool it needs, does it?
What the commission did was look in good faith to the kinds of things that the legislature said ought to be done when you see that a utility doesn't have estimated stranded costs.
My point is that 255 doesn't give the legislature authority for what it's done.
It did not give there is nothing that specifically says the commission shall do this. 262A, in conjunction with the commission's obligation to set just and reasonable rates in 2002 to 2004, in conjunction with having to do the statutorily mandated true-up is the basis for the commission's authority.
In the order on consolidated issues that I'm not sure I understand, the commission said that a transfer of funds from the unbundled successor generation entity to the TDU would be required to make up the revenue loss by the TDU due to the excess mitigation charge.
Right.
This means redress would require certainty of funding, perhaps through an escrow or fund or similar agreement. What is that? What is that mean?
The concept, I think, I don't know if that's actually been implemented. I just don't know. But the concept is that the excess mitigation charge reflects the excess earnings. And the excess mitigation credit that the commission has implemented, has ordered, is reflected in that, for residential customers, $2 less that will be charged by the T&D utility to give $2 cost savings to each of the affiliated retail providers, including TXU, the monopolist. What the commission is saying there is that the Transmission Distribution Utility, is giving that $2 cost break to the retailers, but it shouldn't be held responsible for that because the mitigation, the question of stranded costs, lies with the over-mitigation stranded costs lies with
the power
generation company.
So there's going to have to be...
Yes. Yes.
It's right now it would be coming out of high of the T&D, and there's going to have to be some transfer of money.
I think that's exactly.
And again, where's the statute contemplate?
The statute does not specifically say that, Your Honor. The statute doesn't specifically say that despite the detailed way of allocating revenues for recovery of securitization on securitization bonds, that there can be an adjustment to that, and yet this court recognized the flexibility in the statute to deal with circumstances that clearly, in our situation, comport with what the legislature obviously intended, which is that utilities that have estimated stranded costs by all means should use the stranded cost mitigation provisions, and utilities that don't should not. And that's a judgment that's true to the structure of the statute. It's fair to utilities all the way around to the ratepayers and to the competitors as well.
Mr. Barron, let me ask just a couple of quick questions.
Sure.
Based on your experience, this true-up proceeding, which, as I understand it, can't start until January of 2004, here we are a year and a half after the 2000-2001 proceedings. How long is the true-up going to last?
I think that that is an excellent question that I don't think anyone here knows the answer to. But there are a lot of things to be done, and if the length of time that this proceeding has taken is any measure you're talking about, I think the better, perhaps the better part of the year. But
the
it's speculation.
Price to beat, as I understand it, for existing or affiliated REPs drops 3 years. Drops end of 2004, correct?
There are two parts to that requirement. The affiliated retailer must charge only that price, the price to beat, for 3 years or until it loses 50% of its
which
market.
In the 3 years would run out December 31, 2004.
We're talking up to 2005. From 1-2002 to 1-2005.
So, am I correct in thinking, assume at the trip we find there were in fact negative stranded costs, we need to drop the T&D rates, the affiliated RAP will be able to come down with everybody else, with all the new competitors too, right?
Yes, and in fact the affiliated RAP can do that right now for everybody except for the large industrials. It's not constrained by the price to beat at all. For the large industrial customers.
So by the time we finish the true-up, headroom's not going to be a question. It's not going to be guaranteed to anybody by statute.
That's right. Once the price to be goes away. I want to add on to finish on that price to be. The utility affiliated rep may depart from that price to be after 3 years or when it loses 40% of the market. It must continue to offer that anyway.
To the people who want to pay more
people
if the price
has
gone down.
Exactly so.
Any other questions?
I do. In the both TXU's and Reliant Energy's brief, they talk about that in the 1998 Econ report to the legislature, that depending on, there was a range of values in there, and that depending on what assumptions that you looked at in the future, what came to pass, it was pointed out to the legislature that there could be as much as $1 billion in stranded costs for utilities, or there could be as much as $1 billion in negative stranded costs for utilities. Do you disagree with that?
No, not at all.
So the legislature knew when it enacted this legislation that in adopting the 1998 Econ model, there could be negative stranded costs.
It knew that there conceivably could be. It also directed the commission to do that update based on a 10-year, I think it's a 10-year, I don't think the statute says it, but forward-looking natural gas prices beginning in 2001. So the question really on if you reach the merits, abuse of discretion under the statute in this case, Your Honor, the question is the provision for doing the stranded cost, updated stranded cost estimate, to be disregarded by the Commission and limited only to the CTC, and a blind eye be turned to that with respect to the $1.6 billion in
Just so we're clear here, I want to make sure we're all on the same page about what you're relying on statutorily. I thought you said when it comes down to it, 262 is what you hang your hat on. You agree that there's no express authority in 201 dealing with the CTC and with T&D chargers during the transition. No express authority to use that an updated ECOM model.
Absolutely correct. Commission is relying on 39.262A. It is putting two and two together. It is relying on that, which operates as the express qualifier on these other provisions. It's relying on the fact that it was required by the legislature, knowing that it chose a base case estimate in 1998, to do a 2001 estimate.
For the CTC.
And it is relying on its responsibility to set just and reasonable rates for a fully regulated T&D utility, based on what the appropriate amount of depreciation should be for the 2002-2004 period. Those are the three prongs of the basis, I think, on which the Commission reasonably acted, and I think the statute provides that flexibility.
But if we disagree that 262A applies here, that it is really meant for a true-up proceeding in 2004, do you lose?
We don't lose. Well, we lose, I think if you reject that argument.
Right.
We lose on the question of whether there's been abuse of discretion. but we do not at all lose on the question of whether or not TXU has an adequate remedy by appeal, or indeed whether this case is a proper case for the exercise of this court's jurisdiction in the first instance.
But you agree that if it's decided by appeal, that no court can go back and recreate the situation as of January 1, 2001. We can't ever put the statutory scheme back into place.
We don't know that it will how much difference it will make, if any.
We'll never know.
All we have is $2. We may know. We would know better, Your Honor, if we were allowed to have a temporary injunction hearing, if TXU believed it could present evidence to document what the impact would be. But we have next to nothing.
But we'd all be estimating that in the future. Nobody can say with any certainty what would have happened if the legislature scheme had been followed versus the scheme the commission has chosen.
We would at least have some kind of idea about what perhaps the likely impact would be on the size of the customers, whether it's a de minimis amount of customers that might be lost due to this piece of the rates, or whether it might be significant, and also some idea about what Reliant calls the need, if this excess mitigation credit is invalidated, to look at the other side of the coin, to look at all the collateral consequences and see if the price to be therefore needs to be jacked up, which is the position that Reliant is.
Still, my point is the appellate court at that point couldn't go back and say, okay, let's start the race all over.
That's what temporary injunctions are there for, if there's really to be a record to be made on whether something will happen. But frankly, what I heard counsel say when they got up here is not that they're even relying on the fact that they may lose some customers in the meantime. It's the fact that this is the statutory scheme and that the legislature specifically said it must proceed on a day-by-day basis in this manner. And we think that the proper focus is lose 40% in 3 years, and what the commission did is well within what the legislature intended about which utilities truly should be able to apply the mitigation tools.
Thank you,
Mr.
Thank
you. One further question. Are you familiar with the qualifications of a commissioner to serve?
I haven't looked at it lately, Your Honor, but I...
Is there a requirement that a commissioner reside in Austin in order to be appointed and approved?
I don't believe that's true at all, Your Honor.
Is in fact one of the commissioners today lives in Houston?
That's correct, Commissioner Brett Bowman, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
I recommend y'all. How much time were you supposed to have?
I was supposed to have 5 minutes.
We'll give you 4.5.
I appreciate that. I will set aside most of my prepared comments and try to address some of the questions that were raised today. First of all, Justice Owen, you raised the question about whether ECOM model would show the same result if it was run right now based on today's gas prices. And as Mr. Barron alluded to, the statute requires a forward-looking natural gas price. And so the ECOM model, the gas price that was actually used in the ECOM model was the net present value of a 10-year forward gas price. So it wasn't just a spot price. So you can't just say if gas is today...
Would it be different? If it were run today, would it be different? Would it be higher?
It would certainly be different because the net present value of a 10-year forward-looking gas price would
be higher or lower?
Would be different. Don't know. Don't know without looking out 10 years. It's impossible to say. It is true that the ECOM model is clearly extremely sensitive to gas prices. But that's not the only input. There are dozens of inputs. It's equally important. It's equally, well, not equally as sensitive, but it's also sensitive to other things like depreciation rates. Mr. Chief Justice, you and a couple of other justices have asked about the impact on competition in 2004. And to some degree, that issue is a little bit of a red herring for this reason. Mr. Duggan said that if it turns out that there is going to be positive stranded costs in 2004 and there would be a high CTC set at that point, that could impact headroom. Headroom is a relative concept. It's the difference between the price to beat and all of the non-repassable charges, including the CTC. So yes, if you held the price to beat constant and you increase the CTC, the headroom would diminish, and that could have a negative impact on competition, clearly. But the legislature contemplated that, and in 39.202K, clearly gave the commission the authority to revisit the price to beat following the 262 true-up proceeding. So if the commission uses that provision...
You mean the 262 broad power and the true-up proceeding?
Everything. That's right. That's right, Your Honor. And so to the extent that the price would be actually adjusted upward, headroom could be maintained. And there wouldn't be necessarily any impact on competition. Well,
but again, doesn't it go away in 2004, probably before the true-up's even finished?
It's unclear. I'm not... The price to beat will last at least 36 months, and I think it's just...
Assuming the true-up doesn't start... The rules for the procedures aren't even issued till January of 1994. How much price to beat's going to be left when the true-up's over? Not to mention the surely nobody will appeal or seek mandamus after the true-up.
I think it's a fair assumption that the true-up proceeding will be hotly contested and will probably take a long time to work its way through. The price to beat will be offered for 60 months, though. And it will, if the market...
But everybody believes competition is going to lower the price below price to beat.
I don't think that everybody believes that. If the market price of power after the 36-month period is higher than price to beat, the reason the price to beat was put in there was to give residential customers a price protection. And so that price to beat could still be very relevant after 36 months if the market price of power is too high. And I'll just also clarify that when we talk about the effect on competition, we're really talking only about the effect of competition on price to beat customers, which are mainly residential, small commercial customers. For the large commercial and industrial customers, the affiliated rep may charge anything that it wishes and compete equally with all other reps. Justice Owen asked about 254 and 255, which clearly set out the treatment of utilities that had stranded costs estimated as a result of the 1998 ECOM model and those that didn't. I think that that a more general view of those two sections simply reveals a legislative intent to treat utilities without stranded costs, without estimated stranded costs, differently than those with estimated stranded costs. And the ones without estimated stranded costs are not allowed to mitigate. And it's quite clear that based on the latest estimate of stranded costs that the commission conducted pursuant to 201,
well, if they wanted to do that, why didn't they just say, well, if at any point in time or up until 2001 or up until 2004 it appears that they won't have stranded costs, then they're not required to mitigate. Instead, what they said is, based on the 1990 ECOM, you go in this category and you are directed, not, you don't even have the option, you've got to apply excess earnings in a certain way. It's not even an option. So given that definitive statutory directive, you use a 1998 ECOM model and you are told how to apply your excess earnings, how can the commission get around that express directive?
Well, I think that what 254 and 255 indicate is that legislative intent to not allow utilities with estimates of no stranded costs to mitigate.
If that's true, why did they pick the 1998 ECOM model? Why didn't they just say...
Because, frankly, I don't think it was contemplated that a utility that had ECOM, positive ECOM 1998, but that utility would eventually have negative ECOM as a result of the 2001
model. You said it wasn't possible. Didn't the 1998 ECOM model show a wide range that there could be negative ECOM as high as $1 billion or more dollars?
I'm not familiar at all, Judge, with that 1998 ECOM model run.
So you really don't know what was contemplated.
No, but I'm saying that it's consistent. It's a consistent way to harmonize 262A and 254 and 255 to read into that the legislative intent. I think that it's clear.
Even though they said 1998.
Even though they said 1998. Now, and that question, I think, is related to Justice Heck's question, I think, about couldn't the Public Utility Commission simply review at any time and continue to update the ECOM model? And I think the answer to that is no, because as a practical matter, and as a legal matter, on January 1, 2002, the commission does not any longer have jurisdiction over the bundled utility. In fact, there is no bundled utility anymore. It's three different companies, and the commission will only have jurisdiction over the T&D utility.
So you
can't even look at the books of the PGC after that.
You disagree with Mr. Barron on that.
So I disagree with Mr. Barron to the extent that Mr. Barron said that the commission can look at the integrated utility after 2002. It can't, except in the true-up proceeding.
do you think the hospitals, colleges, and universities are correct that Section 39.262E limits the amount of over recovery stranded costs that can be used?
I frankly don't think that they're correct. I think that relates back to the difference between market price and price to be. It goes back to the price to be customers in the form of the retail clawback.
This is a little unusual, but Mr. Barron's shaking his head. That's the PUC's position, too.
I think that's the correct interpretation.
Any other questions? Thank you, Council.
Thank you.
Counsel for the Commission has said that there are at least two lenses to look at this statute through. Well, I don't care what lens you look at it through, and no matter how you squint through those lenses, you cannot make a statute that says excess earnings shall be applied to the book value of generation assets mean excess earnings shall be delivered to retail electric providers.
So you read 254 is absolutely the law. So if you sold your nuclear plant in 99, you could keep transferring depreciation and applying excess cost to it?
I don't know if you sold your facility.
Of course you could.
I think that's provided.
If the stranded costs went away by selling the nuclear plant, of course you could continue to use 254.
I think I'd have to concede that as a matter of practice.
So isn't that what the PUC is saying? Your stranded costs may have gone away with the price of natural gas.
They may, or they may not. We don't know any more than the Commission does. And the whole point here is that 262 does not say you may not over-recover your projected stranded costs or your estimated stranded costs. It says you can't recover your actual stranded costs, a number that has not and cannot be yet determined. No matter how you look through those lenses, you can't make a statute that says the Commission shall accept redirected depreciation for rate-making purposes mean we're not going to accept it, and furthermore, we're going to reverse it all right now. You can't make a statute that says, as 254 does, each electric utility that was reported by the Commission to have positive ECOM denoted as the base case in the 1998 update must mitigate their stranded costs mean that they must mitigate those stranded costs unless the Commission deems otherwise. This is not a case like the securitization cases in which the statute expressly provided for interim true-ups and true-ups that had to occur at least once every year under 39307 to avoid the death spiral problem. This is a case in which the Commission is not given that statutory authority, but to the contrary, is given express authority to do specified actions at a specified time. That time has not come. The predicate for that authority has not yet occurred and can't be known by anybody until the true-up is done.
Was there any effort in this extensive record to calculate what the headroom is likely to be in January of next year?
At the time this record was made, the price of the feed had not yet been set, so no, there was no such calculation. The price of the feed has now been set. It's still within the Commission's jurisdiction. Motions for rehearing are pending. And there is, well, depends on where you stand, whether you think there's enough headroom or not.
Yeah. Depends on how big a head you've got. If we decide that the PUC acted within its authority, then that's it for this case. If we decide the opposite, what would happen? A remand, I suppose, would be necessary to the Commission.
I don't think so. These are very discrete portions of the Commission's rate order. I think we could file new tariffs within 5 days after an order from this court.
Is it mostly a mathematical calculation?
It's only a mathematical calculation.
It wants to know whether...
If the excess mitigation credit is gone and the reversal of redirection is gone, it's a mathematical calculation we could do within 5 days and file new tariffs.
Well, that's a question I had. doesn't that affect your right somehow? I mean, does the commission have the authority if we were to say the commission erred, and they can't do what they did, don't they, or can they take into account now depreciation and all of that in setting your T&D rates?
I think that would follow as a matter of law, Your Honor. If these orders were vacated, then that depreciation would be in the rate base, and the excess mitigation credit would not be there, and a mathematical calculation could be done as to what the rates would be.
When you say it's mathematical, they say in there, the commission says in its brief, that it can't calculate just and reasonable rates if a utility has over-mitigated. And what's your response to that?
Just and reasonable is not carte blanche. Just and reasonable is circumscribed by the statutes passed by the legislature. A rate that is promulgated in express violation of the statutes is not, by definition, just and reasonable.
Why wouldn't we have to remand to allow them to reset the T&D rates in light of all this?
Because they have made those determinations already in the order. They have made the determinations of what rate base is and what a reasonable return is. And the fact that they juxtapose on top of that these illegal orders does not mean that what they did in the other parts of the rate are incorrect.
Can we assume the PUC would not reconsider other parts of its order if they are told they cannot impose these particular items?
I think you should make that assumption. The opposite assumption is that the commission is making end result reasoning to reach its rate orders, which it is not supposed to do. It is supposed to follow the statute, exercise its discretion, and do a rate that follows the statute. These are not areas in which the commission has any discretion. These are areas in which the statute says what is going to happen.
Let's assume, okay. I guess I'm a little bit confused. You said that this has nothing to do with rates, whether or not they reverse these things. I mean, whether the ECOM standard cost has nothing to do with rates. That's a separate deal, and all we're talking about is CTC over here for the updated
information. What I said was that the 1998 estimate had nothing to do with rates. That is what was incorporated in the statute to determine which utilities were subject to the mitigation provisions. The estimate that they have done now has a big impact on rates because of what they have done with it.
So in answer to the question is, if we say they can't do this, then we should send it back to PUC because, as you say, what they did has a big impact on rates. If we say they can't do that, then we need to send it back to PUC for them to reconsider the rates.
Not necessarily, because the commission has made those other determinations that go into a rate case. It is a determined rate base. It is determined a reasonable rate of return. It is determined the commission, the utility's operating expenses. Those determinations are not dependent upon the excess mitigation credit or upon the reversal of redirected depreciation.
But you're required to refund something somewhere, aren't you? I mean, doesn't that
yes.
bother you?
And that is what we are asking the court to order the commissioners to vacate.
Okay.
So that credit would go away.
So it affects what ratepayers will be paying in the future, but we should make that determination, not the PUC.
No, it doesn't. Well, it doesn't has no impact upon our price to beat. That is set in a separate proceeding. What it has an impact on is the costs that competitive retail electric providers will have to pay for distribution service.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument in this cause, and the marshal will adjourn the court.
All right.
Oye,
oye, oye. The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas, now stands in motion.